Welcome to the Low Power Radio Podcast,
the podcast for the recreational broadcaster.
We'll talk about part 15, experimental and non-traditional approaches.
And now, here's the Low Power Radio guy.
Hello, good listeners. Welcome to Low Power Radio, the podcast for the recreational broadcaster. I'm the Low Power Radio guy, and this is episode 2, where we'll talk about my early exploration into recreational broadcasting. I'll tell you about how hobbyists learned more about electronics and how we bought parts and equipment in a flashback to the pre-internet era. In our last episode, which was also our first episode, we talked about what recreational broadcasting might be. We talked about how I was drawn into this hobby and when I learned that there were just a bit more than a few kindred spirits out there. Your quick recap, recreational broadcasting means using low-power radio transmitters that you buy or build, a small antenna that you buy or build, and an oddball collection of audio equipment to transmit your very own radio show to your neighbors, as long as they live nearby. I was drawn into the hobby out of anger when my last favorite radio station left the air, and I discovered a whole world of recreational broadcasters when I started my blog in 2008. Before we get started on this next episode, please remember that this is your podcast too. You can call our Low Power Radio hotline anytime to ask questions, share comments, and make this podcast more useful to everyone. Call 360-474-7262 or send us an email at lowpowerradio@gmail.com. And the phone number and email address are in our show notes. And we do have a couple of listener questions today from a recreationalist who signs his email, your local civil defense broadcaster, who asks, does the FCC have field offices everywhere or just in major cities? Does the FCC depend on complaints from listeners to do enforcement or just that someone from the FCC hears my broadcasts? I'm on AM using one of those Relator transmitters. Why does my range drop to zero at night? Well, first of all, thank you, Civil Defense, and we'll handle the last question first. Most of us working the high side of the AM dial generally get crushed at night for the same reason we like the high numbers, propagation. Our little signals get out better at 1500 kilohertz and above, and so do everyone else's. In the evening, when the effects of the sun are lessened, the licensed broadcaster's stronger signals go much farther, and a spot on the dial that's quiet during the day can get pretty crowded at night. The distant signals might not be strong enough to be intelligible, but the interference will be just enough to knock out our feeble little voices. Regarding the field offices, from everything I've read on the subject, the FCC doesn't even have field offices in major cities anymore. Decades of budget cuts, combined with vastly widening scope, mean that field offices are very few and far between. Links to those readings are in the show notes. I can't speak for the FCC when it comes to what initiates an enforcement action, but I can't think of anything besides a complaint that would get an operation on the FCC's radar. If a licensed broadcaster complains, I'm guessing the FCC's response would be pretty swift and pretty strong because licensees pay spectrum fees, also known as paying customers, so don't step on a licensee. Last episode, we learned I had a vision. A vision to make my own radio. That vision led to a quest for knowledge. Now that I was interested in making my own radio, where in late 1989 did I find the information I needed to get started in the pre-internet era? To be fair, while we didn't have access to what we now call the internet, there were a few emerging digital information platforms that should get an honorable mention. More about those a little later in this episode. Back in the 1980s, your go-to information sources for the electronics hobbies were three dependable partners, two of which are now long gone. You might be surprised at a fourth information source that I'm leaving out, but we'll cover that at the end of this episode. Our two dearly departed mentors in the world of low-power radio were electronics magazines and the family of unique small businesses that advertised in those magazines. The magazines themselves published the few articles that were written in the topics of low-power radio, a kit review, an antenna how-to, or informational articles on radio frequency theory and practice. You'll find links to examples of those very magazines in our show notes. Of course, those magazines were only published once a month, and they were only searchable by walking up to the newsstand and leafing through the table of contents. Magazine articles usually ran 3,000 to 5,000 words and were replete with all of the content known to thrill an electronics hobbyist. Schematics, parts lists, circuit assembly tips, photographs of completed projects, all the same things that make online-delivered content interesting today. Next was the advertising, because the advertising would often lead to little businesses that offered kits, parts, or informational booklets on our chosen topics. More on those amazing, diverse little businesses a little later. The last source of low-power information in magazine content was a wonderful little instrument called a catalog request card. After we'd chosen all of the offers we were interested in for that month, we'd drop this little card in the mail and wait for the responses to come back. I'll tell you about what came back in just a minute.
We'll be right back.
Your identity is much more than just your personal information. It is everything you have worked for, your home, your career, your finances, and your reputation. It's truly frightening that a criminal can, almost on a whim, destroy everything you've worked so hard to establish. Your credit, your finances, and your reputation gone in the wink of an eye. Yet victims of identity theft tell us it takes literally years to recover. With all this at stake, a small monthly fee to protect your identity is more than a good investment. It's something you need to do today. And that's why you need Identity Force. Please use the Identity Force link in our show notes and sign up for the free 2-week trial available to low-power radio listeners. Enjoy 2 weeks of best-in-class identity protection, and you'll see why Identity Force is the number one choice for your peace of mind.
And now, here's more of the Low Power Radio Guy.
Welcome back to Low Power Radio, the podcast for the recreational broadcaster. We just covered how we gained knowledge and requested catalogs, and those fabulous old catalogs brought reams of information about products and often included reference information to make sure we held on to those old catalogs. We've added links to some examples of these works in our show notes. So far, we've just talked about the first of our three information sources, magazines. Now on to our second source of information, those little businesses that advertised in those magazines. The kit makers came and went. They were buffeted by the diseconomies of scale of low-volume printed circuit board production, changing kits as tastes and components changed, and still a relatively small, fickle, and constantly shrinking target market. The parts suppliers' ads, while quite a bit less glamorous, were stable and offered lots of free technical information, of course, to help sell more parts. My favorite advertisers by far were the booklet sellers. For just a few dollars, you could order handy little books with collections of transmitter circuits, plans for audio devices, or general information about specific components. Before we had internet access, those little tech booklets were our browser bookmarks of the day. Scans of those old content vehicles still live online, and some can be found on the Low Power Radio blog at lowpowerradio.blogspot.com. And, of course, that address is linked in our show notes. These booklet scans are popular destinations on the Low Power Radio blog, a testament to the old saying that content is king. The third source of information for our Low Power Radio enthusiasts is still very much in business, and that was the local library. You could check out one of the few titles that featured some useful Low Power Radio information, or you could go to the periodicals section and read an electronics magazine you might have missed on the newsstand. Best of all, at the time, and that was in the 1980s, you could make copies of library book pages for a dime. This meant you could photocop pages of reference books, creating your own little reference guide for Low Power Radio. As I mentioned at the beginning of today's episode, while we did not have access to what we now call the internet, there were some emerging digital platforms for sharing information. We had national systems like CompuServe and AOL, and we had local services called bulletin board systems with dial-up connections for file sharing and downloading a type of app called Shareware. Both gave access to a collection of servers called Usenet on a relay connection called FidoNet. We could exchange messages and files in 3 days' time. It was considered a miracle. Early stars of the radio news groups were hackable low-power FM transmitters based on the old BA-1404 integrated circuit, and on the AM side, there were lots of conversations about converting old ham transmitters for use on the AM broadcast. There was also lots of chatter from the now-defunct DePonte and LPB transmitter sellers, and a new entry at the time, the now-venerable Hamilton Rangemaster low-power AM transmitter. Links to examples of the BA-1404 circuit hacks, DePonte, and LPB, as well as a current site for the Hamilton Rangemaster, those are all in our show notes, so be sure to visit our show notes for more information. Before I go any farther, I should probably make good on a promise I made earlier in this episode. Who was that potential partner, partner number 4 in low-power radio that I left out earlier? A great potential partner in recreational broadcasting, who really didn't make the grade, was the old local electronics or ham radio store. The first problem with the local electronics stores was that in 1989, most had already been wiped out by the 1980s retailer boogeyman, mail order catalogs. The one remaining radio and electronics retailer serving my community was a ham radio specialty store off limits to those without an FCC license. So it was mail order for me too. One last thing. When you visit our blog, lowpowerradio.blogspot.com, that's lowpowerradio.blogspot.com, and you feel like you might want to buy something on Amazon, please use our Amazon link at the top of the page. And if you'd rather not visit our blog, but you would be willing to support us by buying through our Amazon link, an Amazon link is conveniently located in our show notes. Either way, when you use our link, you pay the same price you always would, and we get a reward from Amazon, a reward that helps us pay for our podcast bandwidth. And when it comes to bandwidth, I think we've used up just about all the bandwidth we've got available for this episode. Next time, in episode 3, I'll get ready to make radio. I'll tell you all about setting up my first station, what I learned, what I chose, and what I used, and what happened. And that's all coming up in episode 3. So that's it for this episode. Now it's your turn. Call our Low Power Radio hotline, email lowpowerradio@gmail.com, and get everything you need for this episode in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening. Now get out there and make some radio.
Music licensed for commercial reuse courtesy of partners in Rhyme.com.
Licensed interstitial music comes from JewelBeat.com.
SoundBible.com provides our sound effects.
Robot announcers are a service of text-to-speech.org.
A free service licensed for commercial use.